All right, so you may not realize this yet, but something massive has changed. Over the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of us have just stopped praying. And when I say us, I mean the larger culture. Not everyone, obviously, but as a society, this practice that used to be so woven into daily life just started disappearing. And before we go any further, I want to be really clear about what I mean by prayer. Because I don't just mean closing your eyes before dinner, or saying a few words before bed, or repeating something because you were taught to repeat it. I mean the practice of turning your attention towards something beyond yourself, towards God, towards the sacred, towards the possibility that you are not just talking into the ceiling, that there is something on the other side, listening, responding, caring about what happens to you. So you speak, you pause, you listen, and sometimes you're not even the one who speaks first. Sometimes it's more like a nudge, a conviction, a sense that something is trying to get your attention as you move through your day. So put simply, prayer is a daily, intentional way of orienting your attention beyond the physical world and your immediate surroundings. This episode is investigating the fallout from losing that practice. Because as you'll learn, it has major implications for just about every area of your life. In other words, the thing you almost never think about doing may be impacting everything you care about every single day. And I know that sounds like a big claim, but this isn't just my personal opinion. The more you look at the science around the subject, it becomes harder to dismiss. Now, some of you hear me say, we stopped praying and think, I don't know. That sounds extreme. I still pray. People around me still pray. And honestly, that's fair. So I want to be precise about what I mean. This did not happen all at once, and it did not happen to everyone. It happened on a spectrum. But the trend is real. So I'm 36 years old, and I'm right in the middle of the millennial generation. And millennials were one of the last generations to grow up in a culture where religion was still something a lot of people were born into. The church, the synagogue, the mosque, some kind of religious community. For many people, that was just part of the world they inherited. But by the time I was a teenager in the mid-2000s, something was clearly starting to change. There was this growing frustration with religion, and not just disagreement, disillusionment. Like people weren't just saying, I don't believe in this anymore. They were saying, I don't trust this anymore. Gen X, the people born between 1965 and 1980, were really the first generation to start walking away from religion in large numbers. And then millennials accelerated it. And by the way, there were real reasons for that. For much of modern history, religion was the primary way that people related to God. It gave people the language, the rituals, the community, the framework. The Bible was something people inherited before they ever chose it. And for some people, that was beautiful. But for others, it started to feel like the institution was standing between them and God. Like before they could even get to the divine, they had to go through all of this baggage. For some people, it was the politics. For others, the hypocrisy, the scandals, the judgment, the way gay people were talked about, the way science started to feel like a threat, and maybe most of all, the feeling that honest questions weren't safe. And whether every one of those perceptions was fair in every case is almost beside the point, because millions of people genuinely felt it. Study after study in the 2000s and 2010s showed this. In one survey of non-Christians between the ages of 16 and 29, 87% described Christians as judgmental. 85% saw them as hypocritical, and 91% viewed Christianity as anti-gay. Again, you might debate how fair those perceptions were, but you cannot ignore the fact that they were there. And that matters because for a lot of people, religion was the only framework they had for understanding God. So when religion became toxic to them, God started to feel toxic too. It wasn't just, I don't want to go to church. It became, if this is what God is like, why would I ever want to be close to him? And for a growing number of people, that shift went even further. It wasn't just God exists and I don't like him. It became a God like this probably doesn't exist at all. That's when atheism really started to surge. And once God disappears, prayer usually disappears too. Because at that point, why would you pray to someone you no longer believe is there? And this shift was huge. The numbers are honestly kind of shocking. In the late 1940s, almost everyone in America still identified with some kind of religious tradition. Only about 2% of Americans said they had no religious preference. 2%! Basically a rounding error. By 2007, that number was 16%. By 2022, it was around 31%. So in one lifetime, the religiously unaffiliated went from almost no one to almost 1 in 3 adults. And this is not just an American story. Across much of the modern West, you see the same pattern. And in some places, it's even more extreme. China is now one of the most atheistic countries in the world. And you see very high levels of non-belief in places like Norway, the United Kingdom, South Korea, France, Denmark, Japan, Spain, Finland, everywhere. But the deeper shift is not just what people call themselves, it's what people actually practice. Because you can still carry a religious identity and lose that daily rhythm. Even among Christians, the number of people who say they pray every day dropped from 58% in 2007 to 44% today. And attendance has shifted too. From the early 1990s to 2008, most U.S. adults still said they went to religious services at least once a month. Since 2018, most say they rarely go or never go. So no matter which window you look through, belief, affiliation, attendance, prayer, the same thing is happening. And then you get to Gen Z. And this is what I find really interesting. Because Gen X started walking away, millennials accelerated it, and by the time Gen Z came along, a lot of them weren't just leaving prayer behind. They never inherited the practice to begin with. For many of them, there was no Bible on the shelf, no prayer before dinner, no daily practice of speaking to God. So today, only about 27% of adults aged 18 to 24 say they pray every day. Now, yes, all of these numbers are estimates, and every person's story is different, but the larger direction is hard to ignore. This is an unprecedented turn. Because across recorded history, human beings have always had some way of reaching beyond themselves. Some way of praying, asking, offering, listening, turning toward the divine. So when we say first generation, we don't mean every single person stopped praying. We mean something much deeper. A practice that appears to be woven into how human beings have always found meaning is no longer being passed down in the same way. And a lot of people are growing up now without even knowing what was lost. And as a millennial, I can speak firsthand to what we thought we were walking into. Because for a lot of people, walking away from religion or even belief in God was part of a much bigger shift away from institutions. And honestly, that made a lot of sense. The feeling was, we are not going to hand our lives over to systems that harmed people. We're not going to let someone else tell us who to be, what to believe, who to love, what to do with our bodies, or even what our lives are supposed to mean. We are going to decide for ourselves. And in that moment, individualism felt like freedom. It felt like taking your life back. Because individualism basically says, my life belongs to me, my choices, my identity, my fulfillment, my truth. No outside authority gets the final vote. And look, if you came out of a system that controlled you or shamed you or made you feel unsafe, that can feel incredibly liberating. But prayer moves in the opposite direction. Prayer is not control. Prayer is surrender. And I don't mean surrender in some degrading, self-erasing way. I mean surrender as in I'm turning towards something larger than myself. I am admitting that I am not the highest authority in the room. I am asking, I am listening, I am allowing myself to be guided, maybe even corrected. And that is where the tension starts to surface. Because if I am the primary source of meaning, if my autonomy is the highest value, if no external authority gets the final vote, then what exactly am I doing when I pray? Why would I ask for guidance if I've already decided that I am the guide? Why would I admit that I need something I cannot provide for myself? And this is where the meditation app boom starts to make a lot of sense. Calm, Headspace, These apps exploded in the 2010s. Millennials were the early adopters. By 2017, Calm was reportedly the most downloaded health and fitness app in America. By 2019, Headspace had tens of millions of users. And I don't think that was random. I don't think it was just a wellness trend. I think a lot of people had stopped praying, but they had not stopped needing relief. They still needed a way to deal with the noise in their own minds. The anxiety, the pressure, the constant stimulation, the feeling that life was just too much. So in a lot of ways, secular mindfulness became the replacement practice. It kept some of the same posture as prayer, the stillness, the pause, the daily rhythm, the quiet, but it removed the relationship. Because prayer says, I'm turning toward someone. Mindfulness, at least in its app form, often says, I'm turning back toward myself. I'm watching my breath. I'm regulating my nervous system. I'm returning to my body. And look, there is real value in that. A lot of value. We talk about the mind and body all the time on this podcast, but the data around these apps is interesting. A lot of people downloaded them, but very few people stayed. More than 90% of meditation app users reportedly stopped using them within the first month. Downloads peaked around 2020 and 2021 and have been declining ever since. So the question is, why? Why did the practice that was supposed to replace prayer fail to hold so many people? And here's the problem that my generation did not see coming. As soon as religion went away, another god rose to power, the algorithm. And I know calling the algorithm a god sounds dramatic, but I don't mean that spiritually. I mean that functionally. Because think about what God used to do in people's lives. God gave people a way to understand what was true, a way to order their desires, a framework for meaning, a place to return to every day. And over time, that shaped who they believed they were, what they valued, what they feared, what they loved, and the kind of person they were becoming. Now tell me that isn't exactly what your phone does. It tells you what deserves your attention today. It teaches you the kind of body that gets rewarded, the kind of life that looks impressive, the opinions that make you belong, the people you're supposed to envy, the things you're supposed to fear, the version of yourself you're supposed to be chasing. And slowly, without ever asking permission, it starts shaping who you are. And unlike prayer, which asks for a few intentional minutes of your day, your phone wants all of it. Actually, it doesn't even ask. It just takes it. Every idle moment, every meal, every commute, every time you feel slightly bored, slightly anxious, slightly alone. Some estimates say the average person checks their phone close to 200 times a day. And nobody chose that. Nobody woke up and said, I want to reach for this thing every few minutes for the rest of my life. It just happened slowly, quietly, until one day it wasn't a habit anymore. It was a way life worked. And the reason it happened is not complicated. It's just business. And I know that sounds cynical, but most of the major platforms run on the same basic economic logic. Revenue comes from advertising. Advertising depends on attention. Attention depends on engagement, and engagement depends on emotion. So first, the apps themselves became incredibly hard to put down. Notifications, endless feeds, autoplay, unpredictable little rewards. Everything was built to make checking feel automatic. Then, once you were there, the system learned what kept you engaged. And to be clear, joy can do that. Useful content can do that. Something that genuinely helps you can make you come back. But outrage, anxiety, social comparison, and tribal conflict tend to create faster, stronger reactions. So the platform served more of it. Creators then saw what worked and then started making more of it. And slowly, the most reactive parts of us became the most profitable parts of us. Our insecurity, our anger, our fear of being left out, our need to be seen, our need to know what everyone else is doing, which means the ugliest instincts we have been weaponized and deployed at scale. And the wild part is Facebook's founding president, Sean Parker, said this out loud in 2017. He said they built the platform around one question. How do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? Then he described the unpredictable dopamine hits, the little rewards that keep you checking. And eventually he admitted, you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. So this wasn't some strange side effect that no one saw coming. It was part of the design. And once that model worked, it didn't stay inside a feed. It started invading the most intimate parts of our lives. So take dating, for example. We took one of the deepest things a person can want, to find someone, to be chosen, to build a life together, and handed it to an app. And here's the tension most people never think about. Match Group owns Tinder, Hinge, and OkCupid, some of the biggest dating platforms in the world. Most of its money comes from subscriptions and paid features. So when you find a lasting relationship, you cancel. The app has done its job. But now that business has lost a customer. Now, does that mean they're sitting in a room hoping you stay single? No, that's probably too simple. But that contradiction is real. The product is supposed to help you leave. The business earns money while you stay. And you could feel that tension in the experience. There's always another person, another profile, someone who might be better one swipe away. So you keep going. You compare, you decide in seconds, then you do it again. And eventually you start turning whole human beings into products. And everyone else is doing the same thing to you. You become a photo, a few lines, a split second judgment, a whole human life reduced to whether someone keeps moving their thumbs. And then there's what happened to our sex lives. Explicit content used to be something you had to go looking for. Now it comes looking for you. You open Instagram to see a friend's photo, and a few swipes later, the algorithm serves you a thirst trap. OnlyFans creators market themselves on mainstream platforms because that's where the audience is. So you pause on one photo, maybe you click it, and honestly, that makes a lot of sense. When something sexual is sitting right there in front of you, it's hard not to look. But the algorithm treats that moment like a vote. So it gives you another, and then another. And whether you're straight, gay, or somewhere in between, it learns what holds your attention. And before long, you never chose to build a sexualized feed. The feed changed around you until the thing you once had to search for was suddenly everywhere you looked. And you didn't really opt into any of that. You just opted into being a normal person online. But increasingly, the price of admission is repeated exposure to content build around some of the strongest drives you have. And this is where the irony gets hard to ignore. My generation walked away from religion partly because it felt too controlling around sex. And I understand that. But without realizing it, we handed our sexuality to an industry whose job is to turn our impulses into revenue. And somehow, we're still told this is all voluntary. You opened the app. You clicked. You kept watching. But that's like looking at someone who was repeatedly handed an addictive drug, got hooked before they understood what was happening, and saying, well, they chose to take it. Technically, maybe. But once an entire industry is engineering the craving, choice becomes a fraction of the whole story. And I know the obvious answer is just get rid of it. Delete the apps, put the phone away. But it's not that simple anymore. Modern life is built around these things. Delete the dating apps, and if you're single, it can feel like your chances of meeting someone just collapsed. Delete social media, and you don't only lose the feed. You lose one of the main places people now communicate, make plans, discover ideas, keep up with family, and sometimes even make a living. And your phone? It's barely a phone anymore. It's your calendar, your maps, your bank, your camera, your office, your entertainment, your connection to almost everyone you know. So yes, just delete it sounds easy. Living without it is not. And that's the irony I can't get past. For a lot of us, leaving religion and God behind was supposed to make us more free, more independent, more in control of our own lives. And somehow, we now feel less in control than ever before. Which brings us back to the question we asked earlier. Why didn't the meditation app boom last? The answer is simple. We were asking it to carry the full weight of a world this loud, this fast, and this overwhelming. And it can't fully do what prayer once did. Because prayer wasn't only a way to calm yourself down. It was a way to say, I cannot carry all of this. Take it from me. And we could trust that something larger than you would hold it. And that's a very different thing. So this is the question I keep coming back to. What did it actually cost my generation to stop praying? And look, I want to be careful here. I'm not saying every modern problem exists because people stopped praying. That would be ridiculous. But I do think we lost something. Something we maybe didn't understand while we were losing it. For a lot of history, when people were afraid, they had somewhere to put that fear. They could surrender, they could ask for help, and they could remember, I am not just alone inside my own head. There is something larger than me, something I can turn toward. And when that practice disappears, it doesn't just affect your spiritual life. It starts to leak into everything. And the surprising part is you can actually trace that pattern across almost every area of life. So this wheel represents your whole life. And when you place all of the pieces of a human life next to each other, something becomes visible that's almost impossible to see while you're living inside it. At the center, you have mind, body, and spirit. Your mind is how you make sense of the world. Your body is your physical home. And your spirit is the part of you that reaches beyond yourself, toward others, toward God, toward the divine. And the whole point is, these are not separate lives. They're always affecting each other. And you know this. When your body is exhausted, your mind gets darker. When your mind is anxious, your body carries it. And when your spirit feels empty, it changes how you experience everything else. So around the center, you have the major areas of life we're going to look at. Mental health, truth, wisdom, body image, physical health, sex, purpose, spiritual rhythms, and service. And then outside of that are the more specific places where those things show up day to day. So instead of talking about prayer in some abstract religious category, we're going to ask a more practical question. What happens when prayer disappears from the actual areas of life people are trying to survive? Let's start with mental health. As we mentioned, for a lot of history, prayer was a place people put their fear. And that daily interruption mattered. Because without it, the grief is still there. The hardship is still there. The fear is still there. But now it just has fewer places to go. So it loops, it suffocates you, it gets trapped inside your own mind, and even boredom changes. Because silence used to be a place where you might encounter God. Now for a lot of people, silence is just silence. And that can become unbearable. Now I know prayer has also been abused badly here. People have been told just pray instead of go to therapy, pray instead of naming trauma, pray instead of being honest about what's actually happening inside of you. And this is part of why millennials and Generation X got so frustrated. That is not what I'm talking about. That kind of prayer can make things worse. The kind of prayer I'm talking about does not pull you out of reality. It helps you stay in reality without being crushed by it. It keeps you open. It keeps you honest. It gives you somewhere to bring what you cannot fix. And when prayer is integrated with emotional intelligence, with community, with therapy, with embodiment, with real self-awareness, it can become deeply supportive to mental health. And that's where the research starts to get really interesting. An active spiritual life can have a major protective effect against depression. Now, that does not mean prayer magically removes suffering. It doesn't. But prayer gives suffering somewhere to go. And I think that matters more than we realize. Because without somewhere to put it, the world can start to feel like it's just eating you alive. Without prayer, wisdom gets harder too. This doesn't mean people who don't pray can't be wise. Of course they can. But wisdom usually requires some kind of practice that pulls you outside of your own perspective before you make a decision. Prayer was one of the most common ways people did that. You paused, you surrendered, you asked for guidance. You created a little space between what you felt and what you were about to do. And yes, that can happen in other ways. But if you don't have any practice like that at all, especially in the algorithmic world we just talked about, then the default becomes you, your feelings, your instincts, your fears, your preferences. Everything comes down to, what do I want? What do I feel? What seems right to me? And what gets me relief the fastest? And that can get dangerous, because some of the worst decisions of your life can feel completely right in the moment. That's why prayer can help form wisdom. But again, we have to be honest. Prayer can also be used really badly here. People use prayer to avoid hard conversations, to dodge responsibility, to dress up fear in spiritual language. Someone says, "I prayed about it," when what they really mean is, "I don't want to have the honest conversation." Or they say, "God told me," when they really haven't listened to anything. They've just taken what they already wanted and put God's name on it. That is not wisdom. That is avoidance with religious language around it. The kind of prayer that leads to wisdom has to be honest and humble. It has to include the possibility that the answer may not be what you wanted, that there is really something on the other side, not something you can control, not something you can use to escape accountability, but something you are actually willing to listen to, even when it corrects you. Body image is another place where this shows up. And I know that might sound like a strange connection at first. Like, what does prayer have to do with how you feel when you look in the mirror? But I actually think the connection is deeper than most people realize, because prayer pointed your identity somewhere beyond your appearance. Every time you prayed, you were practicing the idea that the deepest thing about you was not your body. It's not your face. It's not your attractiveness. And it's not how desirable you were. It was your relationship to something beyond your body. Now, obviously, that does not mean people who pray never struggle with body image. Of course they do. Aging is real, comparison is real, wanting to be desired is real, but without some kind of spiritual identity, those pressures have a lot less resistance. Because if the physical world is all there is, then the body starts carrying way too much weight. It has to hold your worth, your value, your desirability, your fear of being invisible, and that is an unbearable amount of pressure to put on a body. Then there's physical health. And again, I want to be really careful here. I'm not saying prayer makes you healthy in some simplistic, magical way. Like, pray enough and you won't get sick. That's not what I mean. The connection here is that prayer changes your relationship to stress. And most of modern life is spent carrying things we cannot fully control. The future, money, children, marriage, health, the state of the world. And when you don't have a daily practice of handing any of that over, it doesn't just disappear. It lands somewhere, and very often it lands in the body. Prayer created an interruption in that pattern, a moment where you stopped acting like everything depended on you, a moment where you remembered some things are mine to carry and some things are not. And that matters physically, because chronic stress affects almost everything. Your nervous system, your immune system, inflammation, sleep, hormones, cardiovascular health. Researchers like Dr. Harold Koenig have spent decades studying the relationship between religion, spirituality, and health outcomes. And the pattern is not spiritual people avoid suffering. They don't. The pattern is that a healthy spiritual life can change how people cope with suffering. And the byproduct of that can, keyword can, lead to lower disease risk and better overall well-being. Now, purpose is where this starts to become really obvious. Because prayer was one of the ways people located their life inside a larger story. It was where you brought the big questions. Why am I here? What am I being called toward? What should I give my life to? And then you stopped and listened. Now, did the answer always come immediately? No. But even the act of asking those questions did something. It meant your life was being interpreted in relationship to something larger than achievement, larger than comfort, larger than pleasure, larger than just surviving the day. And when that larger story disappears, your quest for meaning doesn't just disappear with it. It just has to move somewhere else. And for a lot of millennials, it moved into work. Work stopped being just how you made a living. It became how you proved your life mattered. Success became evidence that you were valuable. Productivity became a substitute for purpose. And identity became this thing you had to build, defend, optimize, and constantly update. And honestly, that is an exhausting way to live. Because now every job change, every failure, every slow season, every moment where you're not achieving enough starts to feel like a verdict on who you are. And I think that's one of the main reasons burnout became such a defining word for millennials. It wasn't just that people were working too much. It was that work was carrying too much. It was carrying identity, worth, purpose, meaning, all the things a spiritual life used to help hold. And now AI is pressing directly onto that wound. Because if your work became your identity, your worth, and your purpose, then what happens when a machine can do parts of that work faster, cheaper, and sometimes better than you? That is not just an economic disruption, it's a spiritual one. Because it forces the question prayer was always trying to keep alive. Who am I if I am not what I produce? And then there's service. And honestly, this may be the consequence I worry about most. Because prayer at its best doesn't just turn you inward. It eventually sends you back out toward your family, toward your neighbor, toward the person who needs you, toward the thing that would be much easier to avoid. Prayer reminds you your life is not just something to optimize. It is something to offer. And that matters because modern life is teaching us a very different script. Optimize yourself, protect your peace, build your brand, center your needs, become the best version of yourself. And look, some of that language exists for a reason. People need boundaries. They need healing. They need to stop disappearing inside families, relationships, churches, jobs, and systems that were never healthy for them. I understand that. We talk about some of those things on this very podcast. But when self-protection becomes the highest good, something starts to shift. Relationships get easier to leave the second they become inconvenient. Commitments get easier to break the second they stop feeling fulfilling. Sacrifice becomes associated with doing something wrong. That is the danger of a culture entirely centered on the self. Because if all we ever learn is how to protect ourselves, we lose the part of us that knows how to give ourselves away. And the cost of that is not just personal. It also becomes social. Families feel it. Friendships feel it. Marriages feel it. Children feel it. Aging parents feel it. And vulnerable people feel it most. Because someone still has to say, someone still has to forgive. Someone still has to serve. Someone still has to care for the child, the parent, the neighbor, the stranger, the person who can give nothing back. A society cannot survive if everyone is only protecting their own peace. At some point, love interrupts your peace. And prayer, at its best, was one of the practices that helped form people who could survive that interruption. It placed your life before God and then sent you back toward other people with the reminder your life is not only yours to protect. It is also yours to give. So when you zoom out, I don't think the cost of losing prayer is that every part of life suddenly collapses. The cost is that more and more of life has to be carried by the self alone. And that is a very heavy burden to put on a human being. Because every generation faces hard things. Every generation has anxiety, grief, sickness, heartbreak, death, uncertainty, fear. Prayer was not preventing any of that. It was never a shield against being human, but it was a practice of reorientation, a way of taking the hardest parts of life and placing them inside something larger than the immediate crisis. A way of saying, this is real, this hurts, I don't know what to do, but this is not all there is. Without that, the storm still comes. But now the storm is all there is. And I think that's why the same hardship can feel so much heavier now. Not because people before us suffered less, they didn't. But because many of them had a practice that reminded them they were not carrying it alone. And a lot of us don't. So what is the solution? Go back to church? Become religious again? Not necessarily. For some people, that may be part of it, and I don't want to dismiss that. But if there's one thing the last 50 years have made really clear, it's that being religious and having a spiritual life are not always the same thing. You can belong to a religion and have no living spiritual life at all. You can attend every service, recite every prayer, say the rosary, pray five times a day, know all the scriptures, and still feel completely disconnected from God. The point was never the ritual by itself. The point was the relationship the ritual was supposed to cultivate. And there's another danger on the other side. There's a version of spirituality that becomes disconnected from reality, a version that ignores the body, ignores mental health, responsibility, relationships, a version where every problem becomes spiritual and nothing gets addressed directly. So neither of those options are going to be very helpful for you. The answer starts somewhere much more uncomfortable. It starts with admitting something modern life is constantly training us to resist. We are dependent beings. And naturally, we don't like hearing that because dependence feels like weakness. So we try to outrun it. We try to become self-sufficient enough, successful enough, optimized enough, informed enough, so in control that we never have to admit the obvious. Huge parts of life are still beyond us. You can eat well, sleep well, exercise, all things we talk about here, and still one day hear the words, "It's cancer." Someone you love can get sick. A relationship you thought would last can end. The plan can fail. Aging keeps moving. Death is still beyond our control, unless you ask Brian Johnson. And tomorrow can hand you something you never prepared for. And yet most of us live like the whole universe is sitting on our shoulders. So the answer is not to stop taking responsibility. It's to learn where responsibility ends and surrender begins. Prayer is how that becomes more than an idea. It's how you practice it every single day. And here's what's fascinating. When you look at the trend lines, it seems like more people are beginning to feel its absence. Not necessarily by returning to religion exactly as it was, but by realizing something is missing. Which brings us back to the meditation apps. Hallow, a prayer app, has started surpassing Calm and Headspace in monthly downloads. The long decline in religion also appears to have leveled off around 2022. At the same time, the number of Americans who identify as spiritual but not religious has risen from around 8 to 10% in the 1990s to roughly 22% today. And Gen Z may be the clearest sign of the shift. About 75% say they're open to the possibility that there's something beyond the material world. Now, maybe that's not you. Maybe the thing holding you back is not prayer. It's belief. Before you can speak to something beyond yourself, you need a reason to believe anyone is there. That's fair. So we've linked other conversations below that explore the case for something beyond the physical world. But more and more people seem to be willing to take that possibility seriously, and they're trying to connect to it. Now, there's a group of people for whom this all gets much more complicated. People who didn't simply drift away from religion, they were hurt by it. And that's especially true for a lot of Gen Xers and older millennials. They lived through the judgment, the fear, the shame. They watched hypocrisy get excused, exclusion get defended, and control get called faith. And after enough of that, something happens. God and the people claiming to speak for God start to blur together. Depending on how religious trauma is defined, some estimates suggest it may affect as much as 30% of the population. So when I say prayer, one person hears connection. Someone else may hear control. One person remembers love. Someone else remembers shame. And you can't just look at that person and say, okay, start praying again. It's not that simple. Before prayer can feel safe, they may have to separate God from what other people did in God's name. And that work has to happen in two places, the language we use and the practice itself. So let's start with language, because this is where people can lose sight of the main thing. We become so focused on what someone calls God that we actually miss what they're reaching for. You have to call it God. You have to pray this way. You have to use these exact words. And pretty quickly, the language becomes another barrier people have to get through. Now, look, I'm not saying words don't matter. They do. Words carry history. They carry meaning. Sometimes they carry wounds. But the word is still pointing to something beyond itself. In Exodus, when Moses asks God what his name is, he says Yahweh, which essentially means I am. And the more you sit with that, the stranger and more beautiful it becomes. Being itself, existence itself, the reality underneath everything else. Now, if you grew up in a traditional religious world, hearing someone say source, the universe, the divine might make you feel uncomfortable. I understand that. But sometimes that isn't someone rejecting God. Sometimes it's the only honest language they have for reaching towards God without shutting down. Maybe the word God still carries too much baggage. Maybe they're still trying to separate the divine from the people who claim to represent it. So yes, language matters. But the deeper question is not, did they use the perfect word? It's, are they reaching beyond themselves at all? Are they opening themselves to a reality larger than their own thoughts, their own fears, their own preferences, their own desires? Do they believe there may be something beyond them that they can speak to, listen for, and allow themselves to be guided by? That's the essence. And then there's the practice itself. Because once someone thinks, okay, maybe I do want to pray, the next question is usually how? And a lot of people assume there is one correct answer, but there isn't. Traditional forms of prayer can be beautiful, praying scripture, the Lord's Prayer, the rosary, praying inside a church. And you don't have to be a Muslim to respect the devotion of stopping five times a day, no matter what you're doing, and turning your attention back toward God. There's something powerful about praying with other people too. That line from Jesus, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I will be, I think captures something real. Sometimes prayer becomes more tangible when it's shared. Sometimes you don't have the words and someone else carries them for you. But for some people, those traditional forms are hard to enter. They feel too ritualized, too loaded, too connected to places or people that make God feel unsafe. And this is where dogma can make the wound even worse, because it tells someone, if you can't come through this door, you can't come at all. And I don't believe that's true. Traditional prayers matter. But there are also deeply personal ways of turning yourself towards God. For me, that often happens in nature. Or honestly, riding a city bike through Central Park. Sometimes I'm talking to God in my head. Sometimes I'm speaking out loud. And sometimes I'm not saying much at all. I'm just noticing, paying attention, sitting in awe. And there have been moments in that space where I've felt something I still don't know fully how to explain. A sense of being loved, surrounded, almost like a bubble is forming around me. And I know that may sound strange, but it's the closest language I have for it. For someone else, prayer might happen through journaling, writing the thing they're too afraid to say out loud. It might be walking without headphones, sitting by the ocean, lighting a candle, dancing, singing, making music, kneeling beside your bed. Whispering, help me, before a difficult conversation. Or looking at your child when they sleep and quietly saying, thank you. The forms are endless, and that's part of what makes Dr. Lisa Miller's work so interesting. Her research at Columbia suggests that spiritual awareness can be engaged through many different pathways. It is not as narrow as a lot of us were taught. The form is not the deepest point. The movement underneath it is. You're admitting, I need connection. I cannot hold all of this by myself. You're turning towards something beyond you. You're speaking, and then you're listening. Now, remember earlier we said prayer is a two-way conversation. And this is where it may start to feel strange. A lot of people can get their heads around speaking to something beyond themselves. The harder part is believing anything might answer. Because what does it actually mean for God to speak back? The moment you say that, people imagine a voice from the sky, a sentence heard out loud, something unmistakably supernatural. And I'm not saying that never happens, but I don't think that's how most people experience guidance. If you're open to the possibility that something is on the other side, then communication itself shouldn't be the strange part. The strange assumption is that it would have to communicate exactly like we do. In 2023, Dr. Andrew Huberman started talking more openly about his spiritual life. And on Cameron Haynes' podcast, he said something that really struck me. I hear messages from God, messages I couldn't come up with. My mind doesn't have the structure or wherewithal to do that. And I think he put language to something a lot of people experience privately. A thought cuts across your normal thinking, a sense of peace arises where there was panic, something keeps pulling at your attention and refuses to leave, a door opens at exactly the right moment, or one closes, and only later do you understand why. Dr. Lisa Miller uses the word synchronicity for some of these moments, events that feel charged with meaning, almost as if life itself is responding to you. And then there's an ancient way of understanding this too. In Genesis, when God speaks, something happens. Let there be light, and then there's light. The speaking and the acting are connected. So maybe an answer does not always arrive as a voice. Maybe sometimes the answer is what happens. The relationship ends. The job falls through. The unexpected person calls. The opportunity appears. Or maybe it's quieter than that. A nudge, a thought, something you cannot explain, but also cannot seem to ignore. That doesn't mean every coincidence is a message. It means listening may involve more than waiting to hear words. Back in 2020, I kept seeing this homeless man on the side of the road with a chihuahua. I drive past them, and every time I did, I had this feeling. Stop. Not a voice from the sky, nothing dramatic, just this persistent nudge that would not leave me alone. Like if I kept driving, I was ignoring something. So eventually, I pulled over. And over time, we became friends. Then one day, his chihuahua broke its leg. I was able to get them to a vet and help coordinate the cost of the treatment. And I tell you that because if prayer is real, it should not only make you feel more spiritual. At some point, it should move you toward people, toward responsibility, toward service, towards love. And sometimes listening in prayer is not even about you. It may be a word of encouragement to someone else, a person you suddenly feel like calling, something you feel compelled to say that helps them feel seen. But look, all of this requires humility, because you can absolutely get it wrong. You can mistake fear for guidance, ego for conviction, wishful thinking for God. So you test it. Does it hold up over time? Does it make you more honest, more loving, more responsible? Do people you trust recognize something true in it? And what kind of outcome does it produce? Prayer does not give you perfect certainty, but if it really is a two-way relationship, then listening has to be part of it. And over time, you begin to recognize the texture of your own voice and notice when something arises that does not quite feel like it came from you. And after all of this, I keep coming back to a really simple question. What do you actually have to lose by praying? I mean, really, 5 minutes a day. No performance, no perfect words, just telling the truth to something beyond yourself. Maybe it feels awkward. Maybe nothing happens at first. Maybe you're not even sure who is listening. But what if someone is? What if reality is larger than what we can measure? What if your spiritual life deserves the same care you give to your body, your work, and your relationships? Because if this episode has made one thing clear, I don't think the greatest risk is that you pray and hear nothing. I think the greater risk is that you keep carrying a life this heavy as if you were ever supposed to carry it alone. So I don't know how else to end an episode about prayer except to pray. And look, maybe you're not sure you believe any of this. Maybe the word God still feels complicated. That's okay. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to force yourself to believe anything. But just stay here with me for a moment. So I've written my prayers down in journals for the last 8 years. It's usually where I'm able to be the most honest. And last night I sat down and wrote one. So I'm going to read you what I wrote. It's a prayer for you and honestly for me too. God, a lot of us are tired. Life feels really hard right now. We're scared about money, our health, our children, our parents, our relationships, the future. Some of us are waiting for news we're terrified to receive. Some of us are grieving people we still long for. Some of us are trying to build a relationship on our own. Some of us look completely fine on the outside and feel like we are falling apart underneath it. And we don't know what to do with all of it. We keep trying to plan harder, I keep trying to plan harder. It doesn't work. We're exhausted. I am exhausted. So exhausted. So please help us release what was never ours to carry alone. Show us where our responsibility ends and surrender begins. Give us the courage to face what is ours and the humility to hand over what is not. Quiet the noise long enough for us to notice you. Slow us down long enough to listen. Give us wisdom when we feel lost, peace where we feel afraid, courage where we have been avoiding the truth, and strength for the next step, even if you don't show us the whole road. For the person who's listening who feels completely alone, please meet them there. For the person who isn't even sure you exist, meet them in that uncertainty too. Help us become more loving, more honest, more grateful, more awake to the people in front of us, more willing to serve, and less concerned with protecting ourselves from everything life might ask of us. Remind us that we were never meant to carry the entire world on our shoulders, that our lives matter, but they do not depend entirely on us. And that even here in all this noise, fear, confusion, and pain, we are not alone. We don't want to carry this by ourselves anymore. Amen.